Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.15. Bet you forgot all about the Suez Crisis, didn't you? That's right, we are still doing this, we are still motoring on with this series, even though the Versailles Anniversary Project seems to be swallowing everything up. The last time we released two of these episodes was about the 20th of April, I believe, so this time, at least, we're releasing them relatively in an organized fashion, so be happy for that, because I'm certainly very proud of myself. It's no coincidence that as my job as a lecturer has kind of been tied up for the summer, I've had more time to actually organize myself here, which means that you $5 patrons, you history friends, you long-suffering fellows and ladies are finally able to get what you have coming to you. So thanks for your patience as I sorted things out and was a little bit disorganized for a while, and into the summer we have some really great stuff to come too. Also, of course, make sure you check out on the 18th of this month, that birthday episode that we have coming. It's going to take the form of a Q&A, but it's also going to drop some really huge news on you, and it's going to be relevant for patrons as much as listeners alike, so make sure you check that out. Other than that, yes, welcome back to the world of the Suez Crisis. If you forgot where we were, then last time when we covered this story, we took an in-depth look at the response in British domestic politics to the news that an ultimatum had been sent to Egypt and that Britain and France had bypassed the auspices of the United Nations. Anthony Eden's government was heavily criticised, but also very weakly defended, in the days of the 30th and 31st of October in particular. But what about events occurring outside of Westminster's walls? What was the foreign reaction to the looming escalation of the conflict? How is the Egypt-Israeli conflict progressing, and what solutions were already being brought forward by hopeful but naive statesmen unaware of the collusion between those three very naughty powers? Well, in this episode we're going to try and find some answers to these questions, so without any further ado, I'll now take you to the early hours of the 31st of October, 1956. Selwyn Lloyd was in the midst of a crisis of conscience and policy, both rolled into one big problem, which he was now facing the full extent of. He hadn't even wanted this. He had tried to intimate, when he had first landed in Sèvres on the 22nd of October, that the Egyptians were soon to make some kind of diplomatic deal. It was all the fault of the Israelis, Selwyn Lloyd claimed, as David Ben-Gurion had been in a rather aggressive mood, indicating or implying that the Israelis had no reason to believe in anything that a British minister might say. Selwyn Lloyd might well have believed that the responsibility for the crisis was not wholly his own to bear, as one historian has observed that it was not difficult to guess that Lloyd travelled to Sèvres on his master's orders. Yet this was all in the past. In fact, more than a week had now passed since Selwyn Lloyd had reluctantly made that trip to the unassuming French suburb and engaged in a healthy amount of collusion. A great deal too much, in fact, had happened since for the British Foreign Secretary to somehow claim that he had only been following orders. He had helped make this bed, even if he had not supplied the bed sheets, fluffed the pillows, or placed that fancy chocolate that everyone loves underneath the pillows. Now he would have to lie in this bed, and what a bed it was. By the 31st of October, the United States was becoming increasingly loud and irritated in its opposition towards the Anglo-French behaviour. The UN Security Council had demonstrated its desire for peace, and then its members had recoiled in horror when the British and French had been forced to veto these peaceful proposals in a bid to ensure their timetable was adhered to. The Arab states had turned against the British for their aggression against one of their own. The war plan had also hit a snag at the news that the United States' 6th Fleet was cruising in the Mediterranean, which made the Anglo-French force predictably jumpy and anxious that the Americans would attempt forcefully to prevent any scheduled landing. For their part, the United States' 6th Fleet engaged in a kind of psychological war of its own against the British and French flotilla moving out of Cyprus as fighters flew over all vessels flying a Union Jack or French tricolour. One historian even believes that this American buzzing in Anglo-French ears delayed the departure of that Anglo-French flotilla for Egypt for as much as 24 hours. In Cyprus, Anglo-French bombers were about to take off in their quest to destroy the Egyptian Air Force when they were informed of a hasty emergency note. Their departure would be delayed for 12 hours. The reason for this delay in the afternoon of the 31st of October was that Selwyn Lloyd had been informed of the nearly 2,000 American citizens who had flocked to the West Cairo airport for evacuation, as per Eisenhower's instructions. This delay caused a chain reaction, as David Ben-Gurion immediately jumped to the conclusion that his allies were pulling out, leaving Israel in the lurch. Ben-Gurion threatened to abandon the Sinai altogether, and would certainly have spilled the beans on the nature of the collusion between the three powers had the British and French actually pulled out. However, in less than 12 hours, once Lloyd had been informed of the American exit, the bombing began in earnest. So total was the surprise that the British planes were greeted with the message, "Can we help you?" as they entered Egyptian airspace. "Yes, please, beam us in," came the cynical British pilot's response. Unfortunately, I'm not joking here. Whereupon the first wave of Anglo-French pilots were led to the runways, and thus to the place where the Egyptian Air Force was caught napping on the ground. This Egyptian Air Force was almost totally destroyed in the 2 days of bombing that followed. Anthony Nutting, for so long an outspoken voice, and later to be an invaluable resource for learning what actually went down behind the scenes in British government during this stage, resigned his post on the 1st of November. Anthony Nutting, the long-suffering voice of reason in the British Foreign Office, told Anthony Eden to his face that, "We would convince the entire Arab world that they had been right all along in believing that we had created Israel as a beachhead from which we would one day return to establish ourselves in the Middle East." Anthony Nutting's remarks were almost immediately justified by the news that hostile elements in Syria had destroyed the Iraq Petroleum Company pipeline, which was jointly owned by Britain, France, and the United States, at that portion of the pipeline which traversed Syria. Meanwhile, on the 31st of October 1956, and against the votes of the United Kingdom and France, the Security Council called an emergency session of the General Assembly under the procedure in Uniting for Peace Resolution of 1950. The British and French had not come off well, unsurprisingly, from their rejection of the two resolutions put forward by the Americans and Soviets, which had provided the supremely awkward moment when Moscow and Washington were, for once, on the same page in that body. The resolutions had first called for a ceasefire and then condemned Israel as an aggressor. As we saw in the last episode, neither Eden nor Selwyn Lloyd presented the affairs of the UN Security Council accurately to their own peers during the Commons debates of the 30th or 31st of October. The Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary both reasoned that they had rejected the resolutions in line with France because these resolutions had cast Israel as the sole aggressor and castigated her as responsible, which Eden insisted was not the case. Eden's horrified peers, both in opposition and some in the backbenches, looked on. Unable to make any headway in the Security Council, the General Assembly was again brought together on the 1st of November, as the Anglo-French planes bombed Cairo and removed President Nasser's Air Force from the equation. The debate went on into the early hours of the following day. After rejecting an Anglo-French argument that the Assembly had been invalidly convened, it passed a resolution urging all parties to agree to an immediate ceasefire. But since this resolution had been passed in the General Assembly, it was not legally binding upon the British and French to adhere to it, nor did it stop the Israelis. Still, with information shedding some seriously negative light, or at least some rumours, on what these three powers were doing, it was apparent that London, Paris, and Tel Aviv were painfully lacking in friends. On the 31st of October, the British Foreign Office had cabled the following telegram to the British ambassador in Jordan in a cynical attempt to fulfil a common theme up to this point, that being, make it appear that the British action was justified under international law as well as the United Nations Charter. The telegram read, "The policy of Her Majesty's government is to take the most decisive steps open to them to bring hostilities to an early end. They are advised on the highest legal authority that they are entitled under the Charter to take every measure open to them, and within and without the United Nations, to stop the fighting and to protect their nationals and interests which are threatened by these hostilities." Apparently, it was now government policy to lace foreign telegrams with some healthy lies. On the one hand, of course, Eden's government had been given legal advice. Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice had been given the task of legally justifying British action against Egypt, and he had tied himself in knots in an effort to fulfil his duty. Yet neither Fitzmaurice nor Britain's Attorney General could in good conscience approve of the plan. The Lord Chancellor, Lord Kilmure, had also tied himself in knots in efforts to justify the invasion, but he had seemed less tied by scruples or the fear that he was manipulating the facts on the ground, and he was, after all, a committed interventionist from the word go. Eden's government had been advised on the highest legal authority then. They just hadn't seen fit to actually listen to this advice. Selwyn Lloyd was content to emphasise how the UN Charter and Article 51 of the United Nations Charter justified British intervention in the idea of the self-defence of its interests, or was that in the interests of others, or maybe it was in the interests of its citizens living in Egypt? When the transparency of the British action was pointed out, though, Lloyd then opined that we say that in the present international system, where the Security Council is subject to the veto, there must be the right for individual countries to intervene in an emergency, to take action to defend their own interests and nationals. Lloyd would know all about the Security Council being subject to the veto. The British and French had just made use of it twice to protect their investment. Lord Kilmure was equally shameless about the grounds for intervention when he spoke in the House of Lords on the 1st of November, noting that we have three good grounds of intervention. The danger to our nationals, for example, to those at Ismailia, the danger to shipping in the canal, which shipping carries many hundreds, if not thousands of people in their crews, and the danger to the enormously valuable installation of the canal itself, and the incalculable consequential effect on many nations if the canal were blocked. The Attorney General had been reading the mail and felt it necessary to make a correction, which he did in a telegram that he sent to Selwyn Lloyd on the 1st of November with contents that left absolutely no room for ambiguity. The Attorney General wrote, I am troubled about the legal basis for the action taken by the government in relation to Egypt, and I'm worried about the consequences for Her Majesty's government should it become known that the law officers are not able to support the main legal contentions addressed. It may be that the advice given is distorted by the need to impact it into a telegram, but I feel under a duty to make it plain that I do not agree with the advice Her Majesty's government has been given, if the telegram records that advice accurately. It is just not true to say that we are entitled under the Charter to take any measures open to us to stop the fighting, nor would it be true to say that under international law, apart from the Charter, we are entitled to do so. Furthermore, it is not true to say that under international law, we are entitled to take any measures open to us to protect our interests which are threatened by hostilities. The Attorney General could send telegrams until he was blue in the face, and he did so, even while he must have recognised that it was an exercise which was increasingly futile as the days progressed. Whatever the contents, Eden's government and Selwyn Lloyd as his second were bound to the course of action that they were embarked upon, and could not waver even if they had wanted to, which Eden certainly did not, regardless of what his foreign secretary thought. These extracts from the government's legal officers are designed to show you guys that at no point could Eden and company have been under any illusions. They must have known that they were going against the grain at all times, and I could spend several more episodes detailing the sometimes humorous but always striking telegrams sent between the legal brain of the country to its political brain. One side of Britain's brain was clearly content to ignore the other. Gerald Fitzmaurice, the Foreign Office legal advisor, concluded on the 1st of November that he and the Attorney General have discussed the present Anglo-French action to Egypt from the legal point of view, as to which we were neither of us consulted. The decision seems to have been a political one, but whatever justification it may possess on that basis, we feel bound to place it formally on record that we see no legal justification for it, on the facts so far as they are known to us and as they stand at present. Tracing the reaction of the country's legal officers to what Eden's government had done and their futile attempts to dress it up as a defensive measure or one which was legally justified also serves to tell us another story. If members of the legal professions in Eden's own country and legal advisers to his own government did not believe that the Prime Minister had a leg to stand on where legalities were concerned, then how could foreign observers see anything but an intervention presented in false terms and organized in bad faith? Scholars, for their part, were certainly not fooled, even those without access to privileged information. For example, the historian Quincy Wright, writing less than 1 year after the Suez Crisis had blown up, and before he had access to any of the legal documentation or correspondence between the relevant departments, was still able to deconstruct the flimsy argument put up by Eden's government on several grounds. Wright said in 1957 that, "If the object was to stop hostilities between Israel and Egypt, it is difficult to see why the British and French should have vetoed the ceasefire order, which had been accepted by a sufficient number of members of the Security Council, including all of the great powers, on October 30, 1956. Such a resolution was suggested by the Charter, and had, for years, been considered the appropriate method of stopping hostilities such as those in Sinai. Under the Charter, the members cannot constitute themselves policemen to stop fights between others without United Nations authorization. While the vital interest of Great Britain in the flow of traffic through the canal cannot be questioned, it cannot be said that in nationalising the canal, Egypt was guilty of an armed attack against Great Britain, which alone would justify defensive action under Article 51 of the Charter. Nor can it be certainly said that Egypt was guilty of violating international law or treaty in nationalising the canal in the first place." As Fitzmaurice sent several memos throughout the relevant departments, filling in his legal peers, he received several horrified replies in response. Some have viewed with very great concern the decision to attack Egypt in league with France. Another was astonished at how in the dark the legal officers had been kept and how the Prime Minister had decided simply to ignore their advice. Another told Fitzmaurice that they agreed fully and unreservedly with the idea that Eden had acted incorrectly. But Fitzmaurice was then plagued by another fear, that because outside this country, practically no one has heard of the Lord Chancellor as an office or understands his position. He was immensely concerned that he and his legal peers would be blamed for giving their blessing to the action. To clarify things a bit, law officers such as Fitzmaurice and the Attorney General were the only persons who, apart from the various departmental legal advisers, had any official function to give advice to the government of the day. Lord Kilmure, the Lord Chancellor, did not sit in Cabinet in the capacity of its general legal adviser, but in his function as head of the judiciary, presiding officer of the House of Lords, administrative head of department, etc. There was a critical difference here, especially when it came down to matters of interpreting international law. Lord Kilmure, committed interventionist as he clearly was, simply was not qualified to give his blessing to any foreign action. This, though, did not matter to the Prime Minister, who acted as though the Lord Chancellor's misunderstood role outside of the country would grant the Egyptian action a legal stamp of legitimacy. This was entirely in keeping with Eden's policy. Throughout the whole ordeal, not only had Eden ignored and lied when it suited him, he had also chosen to ignore the legal protocols in place which had governed British foreign policy decisions for years. It cannot be underestimated, then, just how integral Anthony Eden was to the Suez Crisis. Without him, it is impossible to imagine any such reaction to President Nasser taking place. Everything from the secret collusion with Israel and France laid down in the Sevres Protocol to his deliberate exclusion of legal officers from the debate paint a picture of a Prime Minister who had become increasingly dictatorial and out of touch with reality, and matters were soon to get worse. Donald Logan was the assistant private secretary for Selwyn Lloyd, and we met him before as he transported Lloyd to the airport and then went with him for the first part of the Sevres Protocol meeting on the 22nd of October. Donald Logan was clued into all the departments which followed in those negotiations, and in 1991 he was interviewed by a project jointly sponsored by the United Nations and Yale, tasked with documenting the records of men who had been present during the crisis, the transcripts of which, I have found, are all freely available online, so go and check them out if you're interested. Logan is not the only figure to have been interviewed in this capacity, as we'll see in a bit, but here he does give us an invaluable and underrated primary source, as well as a window into the world which Anthony Eden had created. Donald Logan recalled, "After the nationalisation of the canal, Eden was determined that something quite serious had to be done, and Nasser deposed, and he made no secret of it. He was a man who had always liked to work with a small group of people with whom he felt empathy, working together. Increasingly, he collected that kind of person around him as he faced what he recognised was a real national crisis, and a personal crisis for him. Selwyn Lloyd was always in that group. Increasingly, as the advice he was receiving from the Foreign Office was more cautious than he wished, Eden was discarding his usual sources of advice and working only with those who were prepared to follow his line. And that led to the virtual exclusion of Foreign Office participation, except by Lloyd himself and of Yvonne Kirkpatrick, the head of the Foreign Office. Then, the counterpart to that was that more and more policy was being formed by ad hoc groups, groups being created for that purpose, groups which were very difficult to locate. They were partly military, they were partly intelligence, but they were mostly personal around Eden. The War Cabinet was called the Cabinet by the press, but was in fact called the Egypt Committee, whose members were appointed by Eden to take on the crisis. The Egypt Committee was an organ of the Cabinet which effectively streamlined Eden's decision-making processes when he bothered to consult anyone, that is. Rarely, we imagine, would this committee have had much good news to report once the crisis kicked off. The Egyptians, while their defence against the Israelis had buckled over the 29th of October to 2nd of November, had managed to conduct one critical piece of sabotage. Lacking an air force or a coherently commanded army, they had managed to tow in place several block ships, which were vessels laden with cement, incepted for the express purpose of blocking the Suez Canal. The British and French, supposedly having intervened to guard the canal and protect its shipping, had manifestly failed in their task by the time the first block ship, the 5,000-ton vessel called Aka, was sunk. The Aka was soon followed by 50 more such block ships, and President Nasser, having evidently planned this aspect of his defence better than any other, proved masterful at frustrating any spectacle of the Anglo-French somehow saving the canal through their action, by essentially spamming a load of block ships in record time. Not until April 1957 would the last such block ship be towed away, and until then, several oil tankers and shipping containers were forced to go around the Cape, incredibly enough, just as their ancestors had done a century before. This failure, and Eden's claim that this was exactly what he was fighting to prevent, kind of made a lie of the whole exercise. It wasn't until this great crisis emerged, after all, that the canal had suffered. Before that time, even when the British and French had tried to overwhelm the Egyptian pilots with additional ships in peacetime, the canal functioned as normal. This was a further strike against the Anglo-French, but it was far from the last, or the most damaging. On the 1st of November, John Foster Dulles stood up in the UN General Assembly to make a stiff judgment on Anglo-French policy, and he called for an immediate ceasefire. Up to that point, Selwyn Lloyd had hoped against hope that the United States would soften its tone against Britain, and that Washington would come to see things London's way. This was clearly not the case. Any confidence that the Atlantic Alliance was simply too strong and valuable for the Americans to vote against was declared void the moment Dulles spoke. Who should trip over himself to speak after John Foster Dulles but the Soviet delegate to the UN General Assembly, who echoed Dulles' condemnation of the aggressors, and this less than 3 days before Hungary was to be aggressively attacked. Hypocrisy was in the air as usual when the Soviet delegate spoke, but such was the British isolation that the Soviet voice was far from the only negative one in the UN General Assembly. All assembled were, after all, only debating the measure of peace in the Middle East because Britain and France had collectively vetoed the proposals for a ceasefire in the Security Council 2 days before. But what of Britain's Commonwealth peers? Eden, at least, unlike his French counterparts, could surely rely on a bank of Australian, Canadian, New Zealand, etc. goodwill when the question of Suez was concerned, right? In actual fact, the response of Commonwealth governments varied sharply. The Australian and New Zealand governments concurred in the action of the UK in accordance with their tradition of accepting British leadership in foreign policy, for the moment at least. The Indian government condemned the action taken as a flagrant violation of the United Nations Charter, in spite of the legal lingo to the contrary offered by Eden in the past. Pakistan simply condemned the action and said that the whole Muslim world was threatened by it. Ceylon expressed dissent and disapproval and saw the continuation of colonialism in British actions. South Africa simply noted for future reference that there had been no consultation. Canada regretted that Britain and France found it necessary to take military action while the Security Council was discussing the canal problem. The Canadians, evidently, had the strongest, most active, and most informed position on the entire crisis, and it is the Canadian position, spearheaded by their Foreign Secretary, Lester Pearson, that will occupy us for the remainder of the episode. Canada was destined to play a starring role in the Suez Crisis, largely because of the actions and reputation of one Lester Pearson. What made this Canadian Foreign Secretary so special in the halls of the UN General Assembly, though, and furthermore, what was it that made Canada so interested in the Middle East, when Canada's own native Foreign Office had only begun to consider Middle Eastern matters a few years before the Suez Crisis erupted? Well, to answer the first question, we're pointed to Geoffrey Murray, who was appointed as Senior Counselor in charge of political committee items for the Canadian Permanent Mission to the United Nations in 1955. I know it's a long title for one man to have, but in short, this lofty title granted Geoffrey Murray access to some privileged information, and it enabled him to sit on some critically important meetings and see some fascinating things. Much like Donald Logan before, Geoffrey Murray's observations were recorded for posterity by the UN-Yale Partnership, and it is from an interview between Geoffrey Murray and the project's interviewee that I now draw. In response to the question of why Lester Pearson, the Canadian Foreign Secretary, was seen as such a household name, Geoffrey Murray replied that, "Certainly my first impression when I first got to New York was that Lester Pearson was regarded not only as a folk hero, but one of the household gods. Whenever we were going about in our contacts, there would be some reference, sooner or later, to Lester Pearson and roles he had played. I think, of course, it derived basically from the emphasis which he had placed on the United Nations affairs, almost from the time, and perhaps before the time, he became Secretary of State for External Affairs. I think he was quite prominent in consultations in the corridors and in pressing for a sort of specific role for the so-called middle powers in the organisation. That was one of Canada's main efforts at San Francisco, to ensure that the membership at large was not disposed to let the organisation be dominated entirely by the five permanent members of the Security Council, the so-called Big Five. People of Pearson's generation no doubt felt strongly that countries like Canada, that had made a substantial contribution to both wars, should have a greater say in arrangements for international organisation after the Second War. That's my impression of what Pearson said about various things. It's also my impression from reading and watching, of course, the way Canadian policy evolved in the post-war period, because the key to our policy was cooperating with other like-minded states to make collective security work effectively in pursuit of peaceful solutions." So Lester Pearson had made a name for himself in the years before, and had characterized his work, even before he came to the United Nations, as one of its most passionate advocates. He would need these qualities to progress past the convoluted mess which debates in the General Assembly could occasionally degenerate into. Lester Pearson's greatest contribution to the Suez Crisis in terms of UN diplomacy was his inception of a UN emergency force, which would be approved of without any votes against it on the 4th of November. In this case, Britain and France even voted for it, since they knew that by the time its members mobilised the force, their mission would be accomplished. It also gave Eden the chance to paint the Anglo-French intervention as one which safeguarded the canal until the United Nations could arrive. Even worse, for those that knew the truth, it enabled Eden to take some kind of moral high ground and argue that the British had forced the United Nations to take notice of a problem within the Middle East, which they had been talking about for some time. Nobody had listened, Britain and France had taken the matter into their own hands, and now everything was designed to work out, with an international police force guarding the Suez Canal to the benefit of all. The truth, of course, was far more complex, and far from the British victory that Eden would later attempt to claim. While Eden was lobbying his way past the dejected British and French delegates in the UN General Assembly on the 4th of November, the fruits of these months of planning were approaching Port Said, the mouth of the Suez Canal as it opens into the Mediterranean. the Anglo-French flotilla was nearing its first target, in defiance of all sense of reason and international opinion. Several miles away, Soviet tanks were crushing Budapest underfoot, as the Hungarian experiment in independence had plainly been exposed as a tragic non-starter. Anthony Eden cared little for this. Instead, he urged the flotilla onwards as it moved through all sense of caution, peacemaking, and better judgment in order to fulfil the uncertain plan and achieve the unclear goals which Britain's Prime Minister had imagined. Disaster had followed his every move so far in both the political, strategic, and diplomatic spheres, and now with the critical arm of his plan about to whirl into life, disaster would soon strike in the military sphere as well. Next time we'll resume our story of this flotilla, as the British and French, contrary to everything in the world, it seemed, tried to turn back the clock to the good old days, and everyone else looked on bewildered, still no closer to understanding exactly what these two European powers were actually doing. Until then, though, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956, episode 2.15. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this podcast, guys. You're the best, and I'll be seeing you all in the next episode.